Welcome to Realtors Roulette. Join Nicole, Alicia, and John as they uncover untold stories, insider tips, and hidden truths about real estate. Get ready to enjoy this episode coming to you from the beautiful Qu'Appel Valley in Saskatchewan. Hey, welcome here. We have Mark Kelly with Kanuka Law Firm, and we're so happy to have you to talk about residential real estate.
All the joy of residential real estate, really. We're just going to come together and make some magic today. I really like it.
Yeah. I'm sure our listeners have lots of questions for our law expert. And one question we have is, what drew you to specialize in residential real estate?
Okay, a couple of things. Lawyers have really funny rules. Specialization is kind of a really weird one. So I practice in the area. I've practiced in the area a lot in probably the last 10 years.
Yeah.
I am not an expert, quote unquote, or a specialist in any particular way. But the reason I work so much in real estate right now, there was a guy who was retiring about 11 or 12 years ago, a retired lawyer, Randy Baker. He was kind of well-known in the space. And I was working primarily in family law at that time, and it just wasn't a good fit. I could deal with the clients, but all of a sudden you had to split up a family pet, and it got really messy when you try to cut a dog in half, but
yeah.
We didn't do that. And so I decided that we would end up going in and kind of taking over this guy's practice. And so he had, it was funny, because I mean, he was an elderly gentleman, and he knew a lot of elderly realtors, so I transitioned to kind of working in his space, and it was a really big learning curve, because I, like, all these old guys were used to working with old guys, and I was this young guy who was new in the scene, and I just kind of had to learn the job and learn to work with these guys and build my practice from there.
Wow, that's awesome. So I guess getting to know real estate agents, builders, developers, that was something that you kind of transitioned into, and you certainly put your own spin on it with your, you're a little bit more tech savvy than some of your predecessors.
No, for sure. And I like very early on, I started doing a lot through social media, specifically Twitter. Twitter, when it was, you know, 10 or 11 years ago, was a much more social space than it is now, which is kind of a fairly angry space. And so there was a couple of mortgage brokers and realtors in the city that were really kind of focusing a lot of attention on it and building some community around it. And so I started going on that, and there were some other apps, like LinkedIn as an example. I think one of the things that you used to be able to do with LinkedIn, maybe you still can, is you can put certain skill sets that you had. And I thought it would be really funny to be the like best known bear wrestling lawyer in probably the world. And so I put bear wrestling as one of my skill sets and try to get everyone to recommend me as a bear wrestler.
Oh,
and I've got about like 50 recommendations of my bear wrestling skills on my LinkedIn profile. And it just kind of took on a life of its own.
That would be a great topic for our next podcast or content piece.
How did that work for you?
Yeah, for sure. So getting the hook, getting the marketing going and everything like that, coming out to small towns to have a satellite office, and what have you found is kind of the difference between the city and the small town?
It's been an interesting journey to come out to the fort. And in a part, because I think the timing of it, like, I naturally would probably be, I would have liked to have been more engaged and more involved in the community when it first got started, but we were in the middle of COVID. And so it was really hard to do that. And I think all of a sudden COVID hit and we were all just super busy. And so the ability and the time to kind of put more energy into building within the community, I think, came to be less and less of an opportunity. So I think that's where I'd probably like to be with it, where all of a sudden I'm really trying to make some connections locally to build some of that practice up, and probably have some of kind of the other lawyers at the firm participate in that in some way. So, but I like it. I like the pace of it. I like the community feel to it. I like that you guys have these you know, funny stories about unique characters locally or unique buildings or unique, you know, anything. There's always just like, oh yeah, that's my, you know, my brother's best friend from high school that all of a sudden they went out and like ran over that thing that, you know, and they caused an accident and there was a new renter that was there and he came out, you know, not wearing pants and it was all... That's what I like, is that you have that kind of intimate depth knowledge of the community that you find yourself in.
Nice. Oh, that's very good.
Well, I don't know. We can dive into some questions. I think one of the questions that I have, because this has been happening lots, you know, when I mad text you like, hey, Mark, do we got key release? Is key release.
I have to say I appreciate that in the time that we've gotten to know each other, you've now preempted those with, good morning, Mark. How are you? What are my key release?
Okay, now we're talking about Mickey's person here.
Could be like 3 or 4 days before the possession's happening. I appreciate that kind of level of dedication to the task. But yes, you want to know about it. So anything specific?
Well, just because obviously it seems that we're getting key release, like, you know, at night or that morning, like we're not meeting sometimes the deadlines, not maybe necessarily with you, but... just why is that? Like, why is it so tight right now to get those keys released? And it's like, seems to be the last minute on every single deal.
Totally fair question. I'm not sure where I fit in the podcast schedule, but if you have your mortgage broker specialist before me, listen to that one. She'll talk about some aspect of some of the changes in the industry. The time frames of when we're getting instructed. So because everything's taking longer in terms of the requirements to get financing, the mortgage instructions, I find that you guys also get pressed to make deals happen quicker. So deals are happening quicker, mortgages are taking longer to get processed. Everything kind of downloads to the lawyer as being the last point of getting stuff done at the very last minute before the transaction closes. So, you know, it was terrible, but it wasn't uncommon in the middle of peak COVID to get mortgage instructions on a deal 3 days before the transaction was set to close. So that would mean that my staff would then have to generate all the documents, we'd have to do all the calculations, we'd have to do all the searches, and then find a way to get that client in. And clients not finding the same kind of urgency because of what's going on in their own lives to meet. So we'd all of a sudden have someone who's like, you know, can I come in at, you know, Friday at 11 p.m. to sign my documents for Monday at 9 a.m. to close? And I mean, it's a bit of an extreme, but it's, you know, that kind of urgency and that kind of issue that would pop up. And then that's not the end of the transaction, right? Like, so we get all the money in, we get, and to be fair, it's not always that the clients have their ducks in a row either, as you can well imagine. You know, we ask for stuff and in the same light, they don't always provide it, or they do kind of half measures or whatever. And
it's
so,
the insurance, it's the...
Yeah, it's insurance. It's like, oh, I only brought in my passport that expired like 3 years ago for my piece of ID, or... you know, any of those kind of pieces where all of a sudden we need them to do something and they kind of just hope that whatever they do is just enough and inevitably it isn't. That is kind of the thing that we run into. So we get that and then we've got to send everything off to the lender, and the lender, depending on the lender that you're dealing with, has different levels of particularity associated with it. So, you know, I had one last week where they were upset that we didn't have... like a slash on an address. So it was like care of, and they wanted the C/O, not the CO. And they came back and they asked for that to be amended as part of a list of 3 or 4 other little things. We as lawyers have to make sure that we're in a position that that mortgage is going to fund, so that we've done everything that the lender has required us to do and that funds are going to be releasable. There's a certain amount of experience piece of that that kind of comes into play, that says, okay, if we have like this little checkbox that we know is going to be dealt with, I'm not going to need to get the final okay from the lender for that particular piece. But it's for the most part, if there's something that's substantive, I want to make sure that the lender's looked at it and they're satisfied and that we're going to move forward with the transaction. So that tends to be the last piece in the line that says, okay, the lender's okay, they're going to fund. It's not even that we need money, it's that we need that to happen before we can release keys. Second part of that question, there is also some differing practices across the province in terms of when key release actually can happen. So it's kind of a Regina-Saskatoon split, but we see now that more and more that people are meeting virtually with their clients, that we're seeing a lot more kind of like Saskatoon lawyers dealing with some Regina transactions or Fort transactions and vice versa. And so Saskatoon lawyers tend to require money to be in their trust account, or at least the what they call the cash to close, so anything that isn't mortgage financing, before they release keys. So depending on when we get that money, when we can send it to them, and usually it's done kind of directly through the financial institutions, and when they see it on their account, and then when they finally decide to talk to the realtor, then at that point in time, there's kind of delays in key release as well.
Okay, good to know. I guess another thing from sellers, because I always get this too, when should a seller, you know, expect their money upon close? Because I'll have people call me that morning like, I don't have my money, like, what's
and that just kind of relates back to what you were just kind of talking about between Saskatoon and Regina. But yeah, good question.
So no, totally fair question. I've written a blog post on this specifically because I've had the question come up so many times. They're in Saskatchewan under standard residential real estate trust conditions. And there is a standard set that lawyers, for the most part, will rely on. There is no guarantee that you're getting your money on the closing day in any circumstance. And that's, I mean, that's aside from whatever's happening at the lawyer's office in terms of processing those funds and whatever else. The reason that is because under the trust conditions, the only thing that you need to have set up for the possession date is, well, this is kind of simplifying it a bit, but you need to have the rest of the money that you need to close the deal at the purchaser lawyer trust account. You need to have all your mortgage documentation signed and ready to rumble, and you need to have fire insurance on the property, which is either you're on yourself or if you're in a condo, it'll be provided through your condo corporation. As long as all that happens, then the purchasers will get keys to the property. However, under those trust conditions, the only requirement is that they have to get money one of two ways. They can either ask for the money through what's called gap coverage through title insurance, and lots of lawyers will do that. And what it does is it just says, we know that you're submitting the property into the land titles, that you're prepared to close this transaction. The gap coverage will ensure anything that pops up over that two or three business days that could have impacted whether they've got first position on title. And if something does happen, then you're supposed to make a claim from the title insurer to fix that problem. When that happens, we'll usually get money on the possession date. And when we get that money on possession date, it's usually then also releasable to the vendor. So meaning that we can let the vendor have access to that money without having to wait until the title's transferred. The other way of doing it is if we have to wait for the purchaser's lawyer to transfer the title first. And some guys will do that generally, some guys will do that in certain situations. And all that means is that it's possible that things haven't been sorted out on the purchaser side until the very last minute, as we just talked about. And then they submit it into land titles. And when they submit into land titles, it's another 2.5 days, and then probably another day to request the funds on top of that. So they're then having about 3 business days before they will get the money from their lender and pass it along to us. There is interest that gets charged on those transactions if they're waiting after the possession. So you do have some financial benefit. It's not, I mean, it's really to cover your carrying costs for a couple of extra days. But that's what happens with that money. Also, on the kind of the third version of it, I guess, if it's an all cash deal, they're usually the longest, because what happens with cash deals is you have to wait until title transfers before it happens, or at least the vast majority of them you do.
Right.
So the long story short, it could be as early as possession date, but it could be 2, 3, 5 business days, depending on if there's a problem with the transfer.
Right.
And so when you have clients that are looking to sell and buy, it's risky to do it without some form of bridge financing if it's happening on the same day.
Right. And back to that point number two, I think actually in our residential offer to purchase, I think it does say, you know, in the event that it's not closed, that they're going to get the Bank of Canada overnight rate plus whatever it is.
4%. Yeah,
right. So right now they're going to pay 9% interest for 3 days, 4 days. So
but, cover- we, We get it all the time. I mean, but that concern of like, oh my God, they have my house. Why don't I have my money? It happens.
Yeah.
But it's something I try to have that conversation with clients when they're in the office.
Yeah.
There's just a lot of information that's happening, and people tend to focus on what they want to hear.
Yeah.
And they don't want to hear that they're not getting their money on the possession date. They want to hear that they're getting the money on the possession date and that there's no questions and that as soon as they get the keys that they've got to check it out.
Who looks after for a seller? Who looks after and when does it get looked after the paying of the seller's mortgage that they had on the property?
So the seller's lawyer will take care of that. Okay. We want to make sure that one of the trust conditions when you're sending the documents over to the other law firm is to make sure that anything that's on title that shouldn't be there for a purchaser is going to be removed as part of the process. So
liens,
mortgages, miscellaneous interests for, you know, that your mom has an option to purchase the place. A bunch of kind of random things. There are going to be things that stay on the title. You know, the most common that you see, for example, in the city, there's a utility easement that's going to be registered against the property. So it'll say something like Sask Energy, Sask Power, Sask Tel. They'll have lines running through the property or the city. And to the extent necessary, they're allowed to kind of disrupt your landscaping to get those lines and throw some dirt back on it when it's done. That's going to be on there. That's kind of expected utility registrations on title that will remain.
So the seller's lawyer is going to look after paying out the seller's mortgage.
Yeah.
And paying out the proceeds after that.
Yeah, we take care of all the money associated with it. We're going to take care of the realtors associated with it as well. You'll go through that calculation as part of the meeting when you're signing documents. It'll say, you know, hey, this is what we're doing for adjustments for property taxes. This is what we're doing for the commissions for your mortgage. There's some information often that we need from you to fix that up. It used to be that we could just reach out to the banks directly and say, hey, we're a lawyer for X, Y, and Z, give us a mortgage payout. Now it's becoming more common that we either need a written authorization, which we'll have a form for you when we sign the documents. Also common that we'll need your mortgage number. So if you have an old statement or if you have online banking, there'll be a mortgage number somewhere on that document that just says this is kind of the mortgage that's connected to this specific property. Most lenders need that in order to generate the payout statement these days.
That's good. Great information. Awesome information. We've been asking you questions one after the other, like as we're all just sitting around here. Do you have any questions for us as realtors?
So possession date. What's your process in terms of like possession date and making sure kind of that the place is
this
going?
This is what I was just going to ask you. Remember when I sold the property on the side of the highway? Mark, this place was perfect when I'm shown. And
yeah.
Then we go to take possession and it's not that and the buyer's freaking out. And so I guess that's what I was going to ask you. Like what can the buyer do if we go there? Let's say it's not our listing. We haven't been able to check on the property. It's been a month, but you know, since we removed conditions, like what can they do if the property isn't turned over to them in the same condition that they viewed it in?
I mean, that's one of those really hard ones, right?
Because
we, there's a bunch of ways contractually that you could deal with it if you thought it was going to be a problem. It's going to take a lot more work for everybody involved with that. And that's inevitably, I think, the headache that comes along with it. If it makes sense in the situation to have kind of some of those clauses to make sure that you have some ability to take those steps. You know, I see it a lot where either the place is a total disaster beforehand and you know that, or if there's some, like a lot of work that's going to be happening on the property because, you know, they need X, Y, and Z fixed before the possession's happening, to have those terms in the contract. And your lawyer, especially if they do a fair bit of it, most of the guys who do residential real estate, you know, they'll have good business connections with the realtors that they work with. If you're having questions about that wording or you're having questions about those kinds of issues, to reach out to them, and they will be more than happy to say like, hey, like this is some different ways that you can manage that. Do you hold back as a possibility, you know, a pre-possession walkthrough or inspection that you're going to have as kind of a term, you know, something that will give you some protection in those really weird spots that you're not sure that it's going to be a happy possession date.
And I always tell people too, if you view a property in a certain condition, it's probably going to how you're going to receive it, right? That's how what they think is normal. Maybe that's their understanding of clean or whatever. So if you view it like that, you're probably going to receive it like that. So be prepared. But like I had one this year that was totally the opposite. The place was immaculate and it was turned upside down when we got it.
Well, and there's a clause in the contract that says if there's been a material change in the condition of the property that technically the deal can be voided. Now, the problem with that is that if you get to that point, there's been so much that's happened for the deal to close that to reverse those things can often be a real headache. I would say from my perspective, what, you know, I don't think it has to be like, especially you guys are, you've got real properties that are kind of all over the place. I don't think in my mind, the expectation is that you've gone out and like personally inspected, you know, right before possession that X, Y, and Z has happened, but at least that check-in or, I mean, like you said, you've got some of the video technology out there. If that's an option to say, hey, like, hey, what's going on in that garage or what's going on in that basement? Have you taken that stuff out? And I don't mean that from you guys' perspective, but as an industry, that there's some that are really good at making sure that possession date is going smoothly, and there's some that it doesn't go as smoothly because I don't think they put some of the effort into making sure that's good to go.
Yeah, I know for us, like if we have a possession, we're making sure that we're going to the property prior, hopefully like the day. I try to get people to move out the day before. And so we can run through it and say, okay, it's good. We've got a day to fix whatever isn't, if they haven't done it. Not to say that, you know, we're not cleaning the stove or wiping out the fridge, but yeah, like we try to do that. But yeah, like, do you think normally like you'd like the realtors to try to resolve it? And then if we can't resolve it, then get you involved?
Yeah, I mean, because there tends to be a bit of a softer touch, I find, through some of this stuff. And as we well know, Nikki is probably the softest touch, right? I think we all have kind of a role with it. I think there's something valuable to kind of say, you know, hey, Mark, here's the problem. There's often something that, you know, if we're in the middle of the transaction, I'm often compelled through the trust conditions to deliver all of the money. But there's also something I think important about me being able to point that out to the other law firm and say, hey, my client's took possession, the place is destroyed. You know, can you talk to your client about it? And sometimes if, you're dealing with a realtor that maybe is a little more laissez-faire about it, or whatever, that extra phone call from the lawyer saying, hey, you know, I got this call from the other law firm saying that you broke the toilet and flipped the table over and, you know, put holes in the wall, that would have some extra oomph in terms of trying to make sure that the transaction, there's something in place to kind of make sure the transaction goes out a little smoother than it has.
Perfect. It's kind of funny over the years that there's been a lot of terms and contractual changed within our offers to purchase. And that's one of the things it's been brought up often, but it's never been addressed. Like, there is no space for a holdback. In our contract that we're drawing, you know, a $2,000 or $5,000 holdback upon, because everybody's definition of acceptable is different from the next person.
And the problem with holdbacks tends to be, you know, then how is that viewed at a lender's side?
Right.
Because that's the other piece of this, is that if all of a sudden you start dealing with things that look like credits or adjustments on the purchase price or any of those things,
yeah,
like it then can trigger some problems for the lender, because if they'll ask us as part of their instructions, and I have to provide them with that information,
yeah,
is there something that looks like a price adjustment? Because if there is, especially if it's like CMHC insured, they're going to say, oh, well, then what we're going to do is we're going to pretend that the price is actually X, and we're going to reduce the amount of financing that you have to reflect that discount in the price.
Good knowledge.
So you've got to be very careful about some of those particular pieces. It's complicated to say the least.
I think as, you know, a brokerage, our protocol of doing the walkthrough one day prior to possession is what we can do on our side. And when we rep a buyer, just having a good rapport with the other agent who's on the sell side is the best that we can do, just checking in with that agent maybe 2, 3, 4, 5 days before possession to see how their clients are doing with the move out and if they're planning to do a walkthrough and leave the garage remotes, where's the extra keys, all of those fun possession day questions, just try to head it off before it happens.
Where do you guys find those pain points with the with lawyers between your clients?
I'd say just excluding yourself, sometimes it's communication. Sometimes we don't always have communication outside of business hours where things go sideways on us and we need help writing a clause in a contract on a Sunday night, we don't always have access to inquire about keys that have happened 7:30 at night. We don't always have the communication with other law firms that don't operate outside of 9 to 5.
I would also say that, you know, communication, not knowing what's happening. So possession can happen. So, hey, Mr. Lawyer, we got keys tomorrow morning. Are we good to release at 4 o'clock? You know, when that text goes out today or the phone call, and they say no, period. But so, but the thing is, we have a buyer that's a little bit anxious. Well, I've signed all my mortgage documents.
Yeah.
And so you got a seller lawyer saying no. But no, why? You're good because, you know, you'll say, well, you know, they'll give an extra sentence or whatever. And maybe it's, I don't know if it's a non-disclosure thing where they can't say privacy or, but I think with realtor to lawyer, I think that it's like, we'll tell you when it's good, go somewhere else. And then we're trying to mitigate the buyer, maybe the seller, depending on what we're repping on that transaction, and we don't know what to tell them. So
I think there's two sides to that. So, there's one side where I think as a profession, especially the guys who do a lot of this, there's probably a role for us to try to find ways to be more efficient in terms of communicating with clients about the progress of files. The challenge is that there is a perception of the simplicity of the job that has really made the fees ground down in terms of level of competitiveness. So you really have to be efficient to be able to do a lot of this work, which means that the guys who do a lot of this work are generally high volume. There's pretty consistent levels of pricing with some changes based on kind of however they internally price things. But it means that they can't deal with it in the same way that they would deal with $1 million business acquisition, right? And some people have heightened levels of communication expectations that's unfair relative to the fees that they're paying and right. to the work that's involved with it, right?
Mark.
And I get it because, you know, most people, this is going to be maybe their only interaction with a lawyer. They're going to do this, they're going to do a will, and they're worried about the fees associated with it because it feels like a big number, especially if you're buying a place, right? Because land titles just increased their fees in July, and in some cases, a pretty material amount. And so when they see that, like, hey, I'm buying a place and I'm paying a lawyer $4,000, $5,000 to close the deal, it's not like... But of that, let's say, you know, it's 25% of that or less is the actual legal fee that you're paying the lawyer to do the work. And when you consider that in kind of the context of how much time that a lawyer is supposed to be, you know, contributing to the file, just based on kind of traditional like per hour models, like that's maybe a couple of hours of time of lawyer time to get you to that point.
Right.
And when you're meeting with and when you're dealing with a client, usually you're at least about an hour meeting for that part. So an hour of it is just meeting, signing, organizing. And then you've got to imagine, okay, well, how much time did I communicate with my lawyer before and after that in terms of getting the file organized and getting the file kind of closed up? Like all those little email interactions chip away at that time pretty quickly. So as much as I'd like to be like, okay, you know, Frank and Joanne's closing today is my whole transaction. And I want to make sure that they understand kind of every step of the way where we're going. At some level, there has to be a certain amount of like, okay, they've got it handled. I'll give you a little more, like we're working through mortgage conditions, you know, your lender's being a little difficult. This is the things we're dealing with. But to advise you every step of the way, okay, we've got, you know, this approval for this specific thing where, you know, it's not going to happen. And barring certain circumstances, yeah. right? Like for the most part, you kind of have to let it happen.
Right.
But the flip side of that is there's probably, there's definitely a role, I think, for us to find ways. I think, and this is going to be the interesting thing with technology, is how can we find ways to leverage technology to be more effective in communicating kind of the progress of things? And I think that's probably where there's a level of efficiency that can be built on, where we can say, you know, all of a sudden you click a box and there's an email that goes out and says, you know, hey, you have met all the lender's conditions. We're now waiting for da-da-da-da-da to happen, right? That's stuff that I'd like to see in my own practice to kind of enhance the knowledge and the communication piece that we're seeing with clients so that they feel a little more comfortable with what's going on.
Question for you. So a person is coming to you to get a quote for your legal services for their purchase or their sale. What are some of the pitfalls that they should be aware of, or some of the differences between law firms when they're pricing a transaction? Say they don't quote in with the land titles fees associated with the deal, that kind of thing.
Yeah, I mean, I try to be pretty descriptive in terms of what my quotes are. I tend to do an all-in quote. So I used to do a flat fee, so I'd say X number of dollars for the legal services, no matter what it is. And then we're going to add on all the out-of-pocket expenses, so the searches and the land transfer costs and the mortgage registration costs. And then what would happen is we'd get to the day of closing, and all of a sudden there would be, for whatever reason, either the client's issue or the lender's issue or sometimes our issue, there would be a delay in terms of what the funding of the mortgage would be, right? And so all of a sudden, it would supposed to be closed on a Friday, and it wouldn't then close until a Monday where we actually paid the money out. And people would be upset about it because there was interest that gets added to that. Yeah. And we hadn't contemplated that as part of the money that they've brought in into us. And even though it's not our fault at all, it's either your lender's fault or your fault. If it was our fault, then sometimes it's a little more flexible about that. But we'd send an invoice off for $80 to make sure that our costs were covered. And we'd get so much grief over, why are you paying late interest? And there was always an explanation for it, but it just took up so much time. So I changed it so that, barring exceptional circumstances, it is an all-in quote, and it's just, this is the number, and we're going to deal with this. Sometimes I earn a little bit more because of that. Sometimes I earn a little bit less because of that. But at least it gives people kind of the knowledge that it's fixed and it's final and that's it. So the piece that I would say to other people is, yeah, ask the questions about what does it include. Does it include title insurance, as an example? Title insurance is something that your lender needs. It's different from all the other types of insurance that you're going to run into. It's a very legal-specific type of insurance. Does it include all the ISC transfer costs, the mortgage registration costs? Does it include, you know, if there's a problem that happens after the transaction, what does that look like? You know, I tend to, some of these situations, I usually won't send a bill for kind of a very, very simple back and forth on something that's a problem at the end of the transaction. If it turns out to be a bigger thing, then we'll have that conversation about kind of the limitations of the initial retainer. So that's kind of all part of it. I think a lot of people, they're like, oh, well, my lawyer told me it's going to cost, I don't know, $1,000 to do this. Well, that's the legal fees that are going to cost. And then, but actually the out-of-pocket expenses on it are going to be an extra $3,000. So it's actually a $4,000 amount that's going to
transaction.
Be yeah.
Right.
Yeah, I think that's important for people to be able to compare apples to apples when they're quoting legal fees, just to make sure that all of the costs are included in the quotes that they're comparing.
Yeah, and I think the other piece to be aware of is when I'm dealing with lawyers, there's a lot of good real estate lawyers in the city and in the surrounding areas, the guys that I like seeing on the other side of the file, and they do a lot of good work in that space. And I think we tend to all be fairly competitive in terms of what the rate are. There's also a bit of a tendency for people to, you know, hey, I've used X for a long period of time, I'm going to get them to do the job. And they might be, they're completely qualified to do it. They just may not have the same kind of skill set or tools to kind of problem solve in the same way. They'll get there, but it might be delayed, it might be whatever, right? So you just, that's why I like working with guys who do a lot, because I think that we can navigate some of those problems a little more efficiently.
The volume that they do, the staff that they have on board, can definitely affect your transaction.
Yep.
Awesome. Awesome, awesome. Well,
if somebody does want to get a real estate quote, is there any kind of a website or anything?
Yeah, I've got my own personal site where you can generate a quote off of skrealestatelaw.com. It's something I've had. It's got a bunch of information resources. So I mentioned the blog post on there. It's great for kind of first time home buyers and new buyer and old buyers and sellers. I put a bunch of content on there. It's been a while since I've had some updates, but most of the stuff is pretty timely just the same. So check it out. Also a bunch of weird knowledge about condominiums, which is kind of an extra area of specialization that I tend to not specialize.
We can have a whole other, whole other conversation on condos for sure.
Awesome. I appreciate very much you coming in.
Yes, thank you very much, Mark.
Again, Mark Kelly with Canuka Thuringer in Regina, and working remotely out in Fort Capel as well. Mark, thank you for your time today.
Thank you. I appreciate the opportunity, guys.
Awesome. Take care.
Awesome. Thank you.
Thank you for tuning in to Authentic Realty's podcast. Follow, review, and share this episode to spread the knowledge. To connect with your favorite local realtors, call 306-695-HOME.